Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie Ngo join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. I'm your host, Cindy House. Hi. Thank you for joining us. Today on the podcast, it's our very last interview that we did on Keyamo 2025, the Cruising Music Festival. And today, as I record this, the lineup for the 2026 Keyamo Festival was revealed. Jason Isbell, Patty Griffin are going to be on it. Also, very excited to see Joby Riccio and Abraham Alexander. And you can find information. Their Instagram is A Journey Through Song. Okay, before we get into Mary and Jamie, this is a really great interview. I loved it so much. Let's talk about a couple things. First of all, our mailing list. It's a once-a-month email, comes into your inbox and lets you know what's going on with the podcast, who's coming up, who's been on recently. Also, all of our innermost thoughts and feelings about the world at large as it spins madly on. You can also follow us on social media for a more watered-down version of that at Basic Folk Pod on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok, and YouTube. We're a listener-supported podcast. If you would be so kind as to make a contribution and help us produce this podcast, you can give $5 a month and get a hand-knit Basic Folk beanie that's made by this podcast's mom, my mom. Actually, this podcast has two moms. Let's not forget, this podcast has two moms. You can make a contribution at the link in the show notes, where you can also find social media, newsletter links, or you can go to basicfolk.com. Mary Gaucher and Jamie Harris talked to me and Lizzie on board the Keyamo cruise in front of a live audience. Very fun. We get down to business in addressing nice things by asking Mary what kind of shoes she's wearing, as she has a reputation for enjoying the good stuff. After that, we asked, and Jamie Harris enthusiastically answered the age-old question, what is the correct number of shoes to bring on tour? They generously share about their relationship, which began 2 years after they met, as teacher Mary and student Jamie were in a songwriting workshop together. Interestingly enough, both Harris and Gaucher have been playing music for about the same amount of time despite their age difference. Jamie, mid-30s, and Mary, early 60s, are both sober and expand on what it's like to be a student of their own patterns. We also talk about their touring life, songwriting processes, the alchemy of transforming personal trauma into art. We get to hear the very cute story of how Jamie first heard Mary Gaucher by way of a Ray Wiley Hubbard song called Name Dropping. Mary, in turn, talks about her first impressions of Jamie's songwriting. Spoiler alert, she was completely floored. They share their future plans with us, where they say there will be a Harris Gaucher album right after Jamie completes the three records in her head and Mary writes her second book. They share what it's been like when they're together and around people who know Mary, who has a higher profile in the Americana world, but don't know Jamie. They both comment that they feel for partners in relationships with people who are, quote, actually famous. We end with a great lightning round, a game that we like to play with partners called Which One? We think they enjoyed that because on the last day of the cruise, Mary, getting off the boat, shouted, thanks for the interview. The lightning round was a real moment. This is so fun that Mary and Jamie agreed to do this. So please enjoy Mary Gaucher and Jamie Harris, recorded live on the Keyamo cruise on Basic Folk.
Thank you.
We're very excited to be here talking to Mary and Jamie today, and thanks everybody for joining us. So, and good morning. Thanks for being here.
I am going to jump right in with a question for Mary. So you are well known as an artist who likes nice things, the good things in life.
Is that true?
Yes. So my first question for you is, can you tell me about your shoes? Can you tell me about what you're wearing today?
Buck Mason.
Buck Mason. Oh, that's a nice ankle
boot. That's very nice. Buck Mason is very nice.
I like soft leather. The hard leather hurts my old feet. Mm-hmm. And I don't have the tenacity of a young person to break in hard boots anymore. And I may not even have the time.
So is it okay if I take that for a lyric?
They need to be broke in already. So I like zip boots. I don't like to be pulling on the two side things mm-hmm. that inevitably are going to break. So I found a nice zip boot. These are kind of modeled after Italian boots, which I really love. Mm-hmm. But I didn't. Let's backtrack. I'm known as an artist that likes nice things.
Well, because you dress nicely. You dress well. You're like a fashionable person. You have a curated look.
This is starting out awesome.
Yeah.
I literally had no idea.
Your reputation precedes you. Well, the next question is related, but it's for both of you. So in my musician gals group chat, we always have this ongoing debate. What is the correct number of shoes to bring on tour? And I would like your take, each of you, on how many shoes do you bring on tour? You know, which types are important to have?
I have strong opinions on this.
I would love to hear
okay,
them.
Okay, one pair of stage shoes, which for me are boots. And I wear them on the airplane because they're heavy as hell.
Can the audience get a look
at... Oh, here are my...
Oh, hell yeah, dude.
Thank you.
Round of applause, please.
These come from Boot Country, where you buy one, get two free.
Two free.
Because I tend to look best in cheap clothing, I found out. So here we go. And I have one pair of a shoe that I love called Bedrocks. Are you familiar with these shoes?
I'm not. Say everything about it.
Do you remember Chacos, the kind of like hiking sandals? It's like that, but like very flat. Mm-hmm. So they take up almost no room in your suitcase. And you can adjust how tight you want them. You can just get in the river in them and then get back out. They dry in no time. You can walk for hours in them. Bedrocks, love them, not sponsored. And and my other shoe is actually my friend who just got off this boat. Her name's Bonnie Whitmore. She's one of my favorite people. She is a superstar. She's a great songwriter, bass player, badass, mm-hmm. and also a road warrior. Mm-hmm. And she taught me about these tennis shoes called Danners. And so they make them in like water resistant or like waterproof versions. And that's my tennis shoe. You can hike in them. You can work out in them. If you get the waterproof ones, you get in the river. So I have like a workout walking shoe, a shoe that, you know, I can go to the beach in basically, and my stage shoe.
So just two pairs.
Three pairs. Stage, the workout boot.
Oh, the workout
boot.
And
then the sandals. Yeah. And the sandals, you can like kind of make them look nice. Mm-hmm. You know? I can't even tell you how delighted I was to answer that question. No one has ever asked me that question.
It's so important.
And I think my opinion is right on the number. So
we have honest conversations with folk musicians.
That's
okay, what's your answer, Mary? How many shoes do you bring on tour?
Well, this is girl talk and I'm not good at it.
I think you've been doing great already.
Well, I tend to bring the boots that I wear on stage and then shoes I can work out in.
Just two?
Yeah.
Bold and efficient.
What's your workout shoe?
Hookas.
Mm, okay. Those are good.
Round of applause for hookas.
Working out on little clouds. And I didn't know about them. Jamie said, here's what you need because your feet hurt. And so they have these very large, cushiony soles, and they really do help people who have, like, achy feet, like mm-hmm. me, from all the years of wearing
a lifetime
this.
Of being on stage.
25 years of this leads to achy feet. Oh.
So, Jamie, you grew up outside of Waco, Texas. Your dad was your main musical source.
That was him whistling. I guarantee it.
Round of applause for Dad Harris. And it seems like your family was very supportive, very musical. Mary, you had like less of a traditional situation down in Louisiana. You were adopted at 11 months. You left home early. What have you learned from each of each other about the idea of family? We're going from shoes right to the...
My whole family is on the boat right now in this audience. I don't
know. Remember, it's honest conversations with folk musicians.
Jamie?
Can you repeat the question? Because I think I blacked out for a minute while you're asking it. What have you learned from each other about the idea of family, coming from two such different situations?
I truly don't know how to answer this
question. I don't know how to answer it.
I don't know how to answer. I think we may talk to our therapist about this the next time we go for couples therapy.
I love that.
And evaluate why we're both stumped.
Okay, well, I have a related question.
Okay.
About the family that you make together. In what ways would you say that you have a traditional relationship? And what parts of your, you know, new created family are unconventional?
I would say, what for me, what I think is maybe unconventional is, like, we, the first 6 to 8 months we were together, we were long distance. Maybe, wow. I don't know, maybe that's more conventional. And then once we got together and started touring together, pretty much the majority of our relationship has been in rental cars and hotel rooms. And so when the pandemic hit and we had a whole condo to ourselves, it was like, wow, we've got all this space. But we live so much of our lives in really tight quarters with each other, and we do really well. Like, we get along really well. We're a really good team. I would say for me, like, I really am built for the road. I love being on the road. That's my favorite thing to do as part of this job, is to tour. And I think, Mary, I don't want to answer that for you, but I think you feel the same way. And so finding someone that loves it as much as I do is incredible. And to be able to share this is incredible. Like, if you had asked me what I thought the person I'd end up with, like, what that relationship would look like, I would think I would live in a house next door to them. I never thought I would have, like, a 24/7, you know, living our lives together in such small spaces. But we do really well. And I think for me, I'm just better when I'm on the road. Like, the skill sets that I have to be in a different place every day and, like, work with different people every 15 minutes, like, I just am really built for that. When I come home, or when we come home, I'm, like, not a good, I can't cook. I'm not really good at cleaning. I don't have, like, a traditional homemaking, any of those skills. I just only learned how to write songs and sing harmonies, pretty much.
So. And that is feminism in action.
I think the best thing for us is just to stay on the road, maybe.
We've actually talked about living in a hotel.
We have.
We have.
When musicians reach a certain level of success, they can do that. I think that's something we've pondered. Like, could we live at a hotel, and which one would it be? Well, you could just hop around if you live at a hotel, right? We do have our favorites. You know, I don't even know what a traditional relationship is anymore.
Totally. Yeah.
We've kind of blown that apart in some ways through a lot of different social change and so forth. I don't really know what traditional roles are anymore. That's kind of gotten complicated as well, which I think is good. But what we have is a partnership, and we tend to do really well in environments I think a lot of couples would struggle in, because it's intense to be in a different town every night for like 19 nights, and we got a schedule, we got to go, we have to be gracious, meet people, shake hands, be upbeat, and get the hell to bed, get up and go, get to the airport, get rid of the rental car, go up, go down, go back to and get another rental car, go. And it can be quite a bit of pressure. And somehow, in spite of the intensity of it, our partnership, I have strengths that are her weaknesses. She has strengths that are my weaknesses. And it really does work. And I don't know how to compare that to what a more traditional relationship would be. But I think that we both feel really grateful and richly blessed to have a partnership that works in the field that we're in, because it can be, the travel can really be a pressure cooker, you know, traffic jams. We're convinced we're going to get caught in some environmental collapse situation.
But you're ready.
Floods, tornadoes,
I mean, we've been in tornadoes,
hurricanes.
We've been in hurricanes.
Two or three tornadoes already. Yeah. I mean, there's always something really bad happening somewhere, fires. This is the reality of the planet now, and we're bobbing and weaving and dodging through a lot of that. You know, we play in the Rocky Mountains, a festival called the Rocky Mountain Folk Festival, and I teach at the Song School there, and it's a elevated place, and the main stage went underwater by 8 feet, probably 7 or 8, maybe 9 years ago. and the owner's cabin and his dogs. He had to save his dogs. He had to swim. The little St. Vrain River became a rushing river, and giant, giant boulders ended up in the field where the fans would come to sit and watch the show. And so there's nowhere that you can go that you can avoid what catastrophic climate stuff. Mm. And so add that to the list of stressful things we have to bob and weave and dodge as we make our way around this traveling life of the troubadour.
Something interesting to note is that you've both been at music for fairly the same amount of time.
That's correct.
That's true.
Yeah. How does having the same amount of musical experience come through in your connection?
Well, I think Mary said, like, our weaknesses and our strengths are opposite.
They're different. Yeah. So we complement each other. Mm-hmm. And I know when I don't know. And Jane generally knows when I don't know. And she knows when she doesn't know. And I generally know when she doesn't know.
We should have a whiteboard.
That was hard to articulate.
This is like David Lynch talking about Eraserhead. I love it. That's fabulous. Yeah, I mean, I feel like, I have learned so much from Mary. Like, Mary is not just music. I mean, of course, musically. But also, like, just like she was talking about, the way that she navigates the road is incredible. Like, a lot of artists that work as much as she does might have a tour manager or somebody else. Like, she is doing it. She taught me how to work a merch table. She taught me how to pack a suitcase. I mean, she's taught me everything about being on the road. And I've talked about this a little bit before, but you mentioned I started playing in a band with my dad, and then I was in a duo and a trio and then a band. So when I quit my day job, it was before Mary and I got together. I put in a notice I was going to quit my day job and make music my full-time job in 2018. Well, I had always had someone else on stage with me before. Mm. I had never really been alone on stage with an acoustic guitar, especially for more than one or two songs. So when I quit my life, the first gig I did with Mary was at HBO. Okay, pitching songs for HBO. So that was terrifying, but great and fun. And then we went to Italy and the Netherlands. And I sucked so bad. I was terrible because I didn't have the skill set to be a troubadour. I was more of a collaborator. I just had always had someone on stage with me. I didn't have the songs for it. And I have a lot of doubt about my ability to articulate what I'm thinking and feeling clearly with my speaking words, which is why I became a songwriter, so I could communicate in song. So having to talk between songs, I thought I was going to die. It felt like primal. It was horrible. And I got reduced to like one or two songs and so I learned how to be a troubadour from Mary. She had that skill set which she's one of the greatest, okay, of course, in that tradition of troubadouring. And also just, I live in a house or a hotel room essentially with one of the greatest songwriters of all time. That made me want to kick up my, you know, how I write, you know, just, it made me want to, I've gotten way better at editing my songs. I've gotten way better at, I don't know, just combing the lyrics over. And we've really started to share what we're working on with each other and have been writing together, which has been really exciting. But that's what I've learned from you, I think. Mm.
Well,
and more, but.
In my travels, mostly I've traveled alone. And so having Jamie with me has elevated me musically in many, many ways. So she's, as you've probably heard her voice, she's an extraordinarily gifted vocalist.
Yes.
She's probably the biggest Emmy Lou Harris fan on this boat. And she's modeled and studied Emmy's approach to harmony is, I think, very good at finding the right note to complement my notes harmonically. And having she hits a note in the bullseye, you know. She's got really good pitch, and mine can waver. So having someone with good pitch elevates my pitch.
Yeah.
I'm not a strong singer in any way. And she's made me a much better vocalist. Just to having her by my side, hearing the note elevates my voice. And she, I think, is intrinsically more musical than I am. I tend to be a lyricist first. I'm really interested in the words of a song and the meaning, and I focus really intensely on that. And I did not see Jamie when she was a young girl, played in a duo with her father. So she was on stage by the age of
10. Yeah,
I didn't get started on stage until my 30s, mid 30s. I was in the restaurant business. I went to chef school, and I had a couple of investors that funded a restaurant, and then another one for me in Boston. And then I opened a third one and decided, nah, I'm going to be a songwriter. And I moved to Nashville, and I was 40 years old when I got there. And at that point, I was really still praying every night that I could one day be as good on stage as I was in the kitchen. Mm. And her whole life, she's known she was going to be a musician and a songwriter and perform. So I changed channels in midlife. And so I'm not musically as strong or vocally as strong, and I'll never be like Jamie. But she elevates me in that way, and it's so nice to have that by my side. It teaches me.
Before we move on, can you just give us a couple of suitcase packing tips?
The suitcase itself matters, okay? If you get a heavy suitcase, you're already starting behind.
That's right.
The heavy suitcase is a problem. The suitcase, let's start with, get an expensive suitcase that when it breaks, they give you a new one. I got this Victorinox suitcase. They've given me at least 10. Yeah. Maybe 11. You just call them up and say, well, you know, it's done broke again.
Yep.
And they say, send pictures. And so I send pictures and they go, yep, it done broke again. And I send them the broken one. And then we both agree they can't fix it because it done broke bad. And they send me a new one. The suitcase like $700 and something, but I mean, when you get like 12 of them at that point, it costs 49 cents.
And this, it's, on tour, it's I have learned that the quality of my suitcase is more important for my health than like my apartment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a
get a really good suitcase that they'll replace for free if it breaks, and make sure it's not heavy. And for me, I can pack in 10 minutes. Jamie's still working on that.
That's true, but you're so good. I mean, my personal suitcase is its own universe, but the merch suitcase, like you have that figured out, like exactly how much merch to pack, how much merch, your suitcase comes home pretty much empty every time. You know exactly how much, well, does that come from the restaurant?
That
maybe?
Is a huge flex.
I ordered liquor for a 3-story bar in Baton Rouge when I was in college at LSU. That bar would do $18,000-$20,000 every weekend, night. I could get the orders right for the bar. Figuring out CDs for a few shows, nothing for me. I also ordered for 3 restaurants, so I'm pretty good at estimating what we're going to do and what we're going to need. And I can pretty much guess down to 1 or 2. I used to be so good at cash because of running restaurants, I could put my hand on a messy pile of bills and like name the within a couple of dollars how much money was there.
Damn. Wow.
That's what happens when you run bars and restaurants for 20 years. You get the feel for it. But I think that, many musicians are right now in transition around merch and stuff. And so we're trying to figure out what we can sell y'all that doesn't weigh a lot, and that's not a CD. So we're in this phase, like Jamie's selling these wonderful glasses.
Cute.
You know, I'm selling bandanas.
I'm in my tote bag era. They're all the same size.
We love tote bags. Yeah.
I have a follow-up question about the liquor ordering. It's not really about that. You guys are both sober.
Yes.
Jamie, you've been sober since 2014.
Yeah.
And you married since 1990.
Yeah, I'll be 35 years sober this year.
Hell yeah. And we have read that you've said that your sobriety has brought a teachability to your relationship. Like you're both willing to do the work and do the self-reflection. How would you each describe yourself as a student of your own patterns?
Still learning.
Yeah.
very hard. Well, recovery, if you're really in recovery, is a commitment to a certain way of life. And that way of life is predicated by humility and willingness to be of service and to have an honest look at yourself with the help of other people who can actually see you. And so that way of life, we're both committed to it. It really does also involve asking for help. And we have a lot of help. You know, we have a tremendous therapist that the first thing we say when we see her is you cannot ever retire, period. Period. You're irreplaceable. We love you so much. She's able to get us back in our skin if we have jumped ship. And sometimes we do, you know. We both have reasons that we became addicts and alcoholics mm-hmm. young. And of course, it's childhood trauma stuff, and when you get regressed back into that traumatized little person, you behave like one. And so we do need help, and we ask for help. I think asking for help is the key to getting help. Yeah. And then the next step of course is to ask for help from the right sources, mm-hmm. the right people. I've talked long enough to where now I've forgotten the question.
But that was a beautiful answer. Thank you both.
Previously, Jamie, I've heard you say a couple of times, we believe in alchemy. So for both of you, what does the intersection look like of, and we love this here, like woo-woo, mystical, emotional intelligence. So that side of life, and then the other side of life, the harsh real world, sweat on the brow reality, kind of salt of the earth energy. What does that intersection look like?
Well, I think I hope it's okay for me to speak. I think we Please. Both, like what Mary was talking about with recovery, we share that. So we also share a very similar mission statement in our art, the way that we operate our business. I mean, it affects that. It also affects, you know, what our mission statement is like when we're playing shows and when we're creating, most importantly. And so I think we both believe that when we're writing, we're more midwives. And that's a hard thing to articulate. Mary actually wrote a whole book that articulates this pretty well. So I don't know why I'm just trying to articulate it. But I mean, I think we believe that there's a seed that comes and then the song is the boss of us. And I can't even tell you how many times I've been writing a song, we've been writing a song together, and the song takes a turn that, I mean, in some cases, I don't even want the song to go there. Like, I have a song called Boomerang Town, and at the end, there are two main characters. One is a 17-year-old boy that works at Walmart that's knocked up his girlfriend, and the other is his girlfriend, Julie, and I wanted her to get out. I wanted her to get out of town, and I swear to you, I was writing that thing and it's like, she's going to jump off the bridge. And I remember Mary came into the room and I was crying and she's like, what's wrong? And I said, I don't want her to jump. And she does. And I wrote that song and I guess I finished it in 2020 maybe. And if I had done what I thought, what I wanted the song to do, it would have totally diminished the song's power, especially now with what women in Texas are faced with in my home state of Texas. I mean, that song means more than I could have known now than it did in 2020 when I wrote it. And I totally could have limited it by not.
That is alchemy.
That's alchemy. And I think we really both share that idea and the idea of, you know, taking what we've excavated in recovery, what we're trying to deal with. You know, the songs are so far ahead of us in our lives. Mm-hmm. Always. I mean, I remember there's another song I wrote. I don't even know how I wrote this song. 4 months into recovery called Snow White Knuckles. And I thought that was a little personal song about me. I couldn't have imagined that I would share that song at a women's prison in Texas, that I would be playing it at a place in Oklahoma called Women in Recovery, which is an alternative for prison for women in Oklahoma, because Oklahoma incarcerates more women than any other state in this country. And there's a wonderful man that's trying to, you know, help that. And so there's an organization that helps these women. That song that I thought was about me was about so much beyond me. And so I think we're just really faithful to allowing the song to be midwifed instead of exercising our control over it. And that whether the alchemy comes for us ourselves in the process of writing it or 5 or 10 years later, we do experience it. And then it's, you know, useful to other people.
Yeah, alchemy is a big discussion. I'm a believer in alchemy, and that's just a fancy way of saying this shit's magic.
Yeah.
A song can take the worst day of your life and turn it into something beautiful that helps someone who's struggling out there. A song can take something that was extremely hard to go through. You bring it to listeners, and it can offer them some relief. So many times people tell me, that song saved my life. That song gave me a life jacket when I was at sea alone, because it made me know someone understood. You know, I had the great privilege of doing a tour with Willie Nelson. And at the end of the tour, we were all standing around in a hotel bar in London. And I asked him, I said, Willie, tell me in your you know, experience, why do people like the sad song so much? And he said, well, Mary, I reckon they figure if old Willie has to go through it, then an angry God hadn't singled them out personally for suffering and sorrow. Basically said, I do the sad songs to bring people hope that life can be a struggle and everybody goes through it. And it doesn't matter if you're Willie Nelson or Joe Schmo, there's going to be times when you're crazy for crying, crazy for trying, and crazy for loving you. And that's the alchemy, that you take this thing that has been personally quite painful and you make art out of it. And that becomes service, and it's of use to people. Alchemizing trauma is something I became interested in working through my own early childhood in the orphanage, and then working with veterans, and seeing just how profoundly powerful it was to get them to articulate in a song what was eating them, and watching their reaction to other people's reaction to their song. See, soldiers are trained not to talk. They are trained that you don't talk about this stuff. And when I was working with the veterans, getting them to talk was a stretch for them. And putting into a song I wrote with a veteran their real experience and their real emotion was terrifying for them. And then when they looked out and saw other people experiencing emotion and having other people come up and say, thank you, man, thank you, thank you, that's me. They realized, first of all, that their experience was universal in some way and that their experience was useful to others. See, we have a military that is run by volunteers. We don't have a draft. These are some of the finest people I've ever met in my life. And they chose to serve. They volunteered. And if you can work through their fear of articulating what's going on and tap into their just nature to serve, they realize that, oh, I don't want to talk about this, but if it helps you, I'll do it. And that's alchemy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It takes something really, really, really hard and turns it into something else. It's taking coal under pressure and turning it into diamonds.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question for Jamie. Do you remember the first time you heard a Mary Gaucher song?
I do.
Tell me your first impression
this
story.
This is so weird. Okay, so I was living in an apartment in Austin, Texas in 2016, and I heard this Ray Wiley Hubbard song called Name Droppin'.
Yeah.
Do you know the song? It's right. Johnny Graham. Never. Oh, do you really? No way. I love that song, The Rabbit.
Because you got to.
Okay, did we just become best friends? Yeah. Amazing. Okay, we have to talk about this so much later. I'm like freaking out.
I'll see you after class.
I love it. Okay. Well, I knew everybody in that song, Scrappy Judd, Johnny Graham, Darcy DeVille, and I didn't know who Mary Gaucher was. Oh. And so I typed into my phone, Mary, G-O-S-H-A-Y. Mm-hmm. And it came up, Mary Gaucher.
We've all done it.
And I heard Mercy Now, which just knocked me out. And then I said, all right. And at the time, I lived within walking distance to this record store called End of an Ear. And I walked in there and I was like, I'm looking for Mary Gaucher. And the guy, and there's this awesome guy in there. He was like all tatted up and awesome. And he loves like Butch Hancock, Jimmy Dale Gilmore, Mary Gaucher. He's like, I'll take you right to this record. He said, what are you looking for? And I said, well, I'm just getting into her. He's like, you want vinyl or CD? I said, I want vinyl. And so he gave me Trouble in Love.
Wow.
This record, Trouble in Love, which is a great, it's like a breakup record, kind of. I don't want to limit it. It's way more than that. But it just hit me at a time when I needed to hear that record, and it rocks. And Mary, I think you self-produced that record. Is that right? With like Daryl Scott?
I co-produced it with Patrick Granato.
Right, with Patrick. Oh, yeah. Beautiful. And that record, I just listened to it all the time. And that became the one for me. Actually, that's still my favorite Mary record. It's Trouble in Love. Who would have thought that this breakup record brought us together?
We love love on Basic Folk.
We do. Yes.
I want to know, Mary, it's kind of a two-parter about Jamie's work. Mm-hmm. What was your first impression of her music? And now that you've been together for years, what is something about her songwriting that you didn't notice at first that feels important to you now?
Oh, so I'm so glad you asked. I guess we're celebrating 7 years together.
Congratulations.
In April. Ooh. Yeah. And I think we circled each other for about a year before we decided to give it a try. I met Jamie because I was teaching a workshop with Eliza Gilkison in Taos, New Mexico. And Jamie was a participant in the workshop. And I gave a prompt for the writers in the workshop using the Emma Lazarus poem from the Statue of Liberty. Mm-hmm. And Jamie came back in less than 2 hours with a song that was so good I couldn't stand it. I toured for a couple of years with the songwriter Guy Clark. Wow. And for many years, journalists would ask me, how do I know when a song is done? And my answer was always, when I'm willing to play it in front of Guy. Yeah. When Guy liked a song, this is what he would say. He would say, fuck ye. Yeah. Just that Texas, you know, draw them both out, the vowels, yee. And Jamie came back with this unbelievable song from that prompt that was so good I couldn't comprehend that she had just written that in less than 2 hours. And I thought, oh, God, I'm in trouble. At the time, I had been single for 5 years through choice. If you read my book, you'll know why. Trying to change fundamental things about myself that needed work. So I needed to be single, and I was single at that point for 5 years. And when she came back with that song, I was like, oh, my goodness, who is this beautiful songwriter? And it really, really, it captivated me. But it wasn't just a song. There was another young man in the class who had won the American Songwriter Songwriting Contest. And he decided to, I was the prize. I'm not sure how that happened, but he won an opportunity to write with me and record a song in Nashville. And he had been horribly abused by his father and had the worst stutter of anyone I ever heard in my life. It would take him a good minute to get a word out. And he'd panic because he couldn't get the word out. And he was beautiful, but he struggled to communicate in language. And the first or second day of the workshop, I watched her ask him to go to lunch. And I just knew that this person is fundamentally gentle and kind and generous. So that already had my attention. And then I heard the song.
Yeah.
And then I thought, oh, but I'm the teacher and she's the student and I'm older than her parents. This is not a good idea. We can't do this. And so I didn't say or do anything. And I just kept it to myself, but my heart was already engaged. But I felt as though it would be wrong to say or do anything. So I didn't. She did.
Cute.
Hell yeah.
Are we going to see a Gaucher Harris record?
Probably.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Ooh. Yeah, we're moving much more into collaborative. Yeah, she has three records spinning in her head that she needs to make first. I really want to write another book.
Do you know what it's about?
This one will be called Troubadour.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. So lots of people know Mary. Jamie, what has it been like for you to be in situations where people know Mary, but they didn't know you, like especially in the beginning? And then, Mary, follow-up question, what do you do in those situations?
It can get weird, especially at conferences and stuff, mm-hmm. When people are looking to network and so forth. Jamie can speak for herself, of course, but we know that there's people who can dehumanize people and people who are aware of the humanity of all people. And those are the people we're drawn to, is the people who are aware of the humanity of all people.
Oh, that's tough. I mean, you know, I love singing and I love playing music and I love what I got to do yesterday, you know, with having my brother with me and my friend of 20 years, Brian Patterson, with me. Yes. Thank you. That brings me so much joy. I really am a collaborator at heart. So it's interesting because, I mean, maybe it's not interesting, but for me, a struggle I've always had from the beginning is, do I want to be a side person or do I want to be a front person? Does it really matter to me? And to be honest with you, since it's already come up, I am a supreme fan of Emmylou Harris. And because of working with Mary, I got to meet Emmylou, who I still cannot complete a full sentence around, even though she's been nothing but nice to me for 6 years. She's like, that girl must only sing and not talk, which is so funny to anyone else who's ever met me. But I still can't handle it.
But she's got a presence.
Oh God, she's incredible. And she's just, I mean, it's like, she's so formative for me. I heard that voice and I went, I want to do that. I don't know what that is. And then when I was 12, I saw her, Patty Griffin, Julie and Buddy Miller all on the same stage on one day. And 2 days later, I wrote my first song. So it was like, that's so formative for me that it's so like, I can't believe I'm in that world. And, a few years ago, I got to sing with her because Mary and I were in the round, and she said, she's like, well, do you know Orphan Girl? I'm like, yes, I know Orphan Girl! I sing every day of my life! Like, I love this. It's my ultimate record! I love it. Yeah. And so, like, yeah, I can do that. And so ever since that happened, it's funny, like, I'm kind of like, do I want to be Jamie Harris or did I just want to sing with Emmylou? Like, I don't know. So all that to say, like, I love being a side person. I love being in a supportive role. I'm more comfortable being in a supportive role than I am with my name on the marquee. So when it comes to like business stuff, that ambition that it takes to like, oh, you need to pay attention to me. Like, I'm not thinking about that. However, there have been situations, I will say, when someone just fully ignores that I exist. Mm-mm. And I'm thinking like, okay, I don't even care about this because I'm a songwriter. I'm an artist. I'm not like, you need to pay attention to me because I'm an artist. Like, I'm a human being.
Yeah.
Oh my God, it's dehumanizing. And that's just a signal to us to go like back away from this person.
Yeah, it seems like a good litmus test of like, can this person hang?
Yeah. 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 And I just feel like, I don't know, man. I feel for everyone who's in a partnership with someone who is
actually famous.
Yeah. I mean, for real, you gotta be tough.
Yeah.
I mean, you gotta be real tough to do it. And I think that's just part of like stuff I gotta work through in my life. That's part of my mission, is like every person matters. How could you treat someone like they're invisible? But that's part of the thing that drives what I write about and what I sing about and what I do. So, you know.
I love that. Okay, well, I have a follow-up question about kind of your origins where you were teaching the songwriting workshop. We've read that you, Mary, have helped Jamie develop your like songwriting skills in terms of writing outside of the first-person perspective, storytelling from somebody else's point of view. Jamie, how do you feel like that shift in narrative perspective has changed how you show up on stage?
Oh, that's a good question. I haven't thought about it much other than, I mean, when I am playing solo, every song is its like own little world. I mean, one of my favorite songwriters of all time is a songwriter named James McMurtry.
I die for James McMurtry.
We are best friends.
What's the matter?
Speaking of being on tour. Met? Oh my God. Okay. I can't believe, I'm just like freaking, this is not professional. Okay. So that's why I'm a side person energy
besties
happening right now. Yeah. And I mean, he embodies narrator, Bruce Springsteen, another one too, but McMurtry really is like one of my heroes in that. And it's something I've always aspired to do. But I don't know if I think about it so much. Like maybe that's what makes me more of a side person mentality, is that I'm thinking like, I'm just here to show up for this song right now. So if I'm singing this song from the perspective of a 17-year-old boy who's knocked up his girlfriend, if I'm singing this from a perspective of a woman who's lost her son to gun violence, like I just become that person. But I don't feel effort in doing that. Where I did feel the effort was making that switch to writing from narrators that were beyond me. And that's, wow, has that transformed what I'm able to do and what I'm able to say? And who we're able to channel. I mean, Mary's got a song called Sometimes that is written from the perspective of a man who worked in the dining car of the Orange Blossom Special in the 1950s. That song, I can't wait for people to hear that song. It's not recorded yet. And to study that, it's just one of the best examples of writing from someone else's perspective. And I don't know what else to say. This is why I write songs and don't talk. But do you have anything you want to say, Mary?
That was for you.
It was for me. Okay, well.
No, it was a great answer.
Mary, let's talk about your business voice versus your feelings voice. Whoa. I was listening to you on a podcast, and you were sharing all this amazing, incredible wisdom, and you have a certain tone in your voice, like you can barely contain the message when it's coming out. Conversely, I think in the same episode, you were talking about business and the lessons of the music industry. You are very clear. You're very direct in your tone. So what's going through your mind when you're in both modes? Like, what do each do for your brain, and what does it feel like in your body?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I love talking about the creative process, and I love working with songwriters, and I love talking about the art form. But I also am really interested in, and I'm an entrepreneur at heart. So I'm interested in business, and a lot of artists really don't have that interest. Before I became a musician, a songwriter, I was a business person. By the time I was 25 years old, I had talked people with money into opening a restaurant with me running it. I can get investors together. I can put a business plan together. I can envision something and make it happen. And I really like that. And the music business was confusing at first. And then I started to see how it ran. And I love talking about business, especially to young artists that are about to come through the meat grinder of the music business. I can advise, I can see what I have hired for myself. This is a new development, an executive coach. And this coach generally works with CEOs of major companies, Westchester County, a lot of people that run companies that are in the financial industry. And she took me on as a friends and family rate. And the first thing we did was a high-level personality test.
Whoa.
And I found out about myself in ways that validated what I kind of knew, which was I suck at math and I'm really intuitive. So I have this intuitive sense of how to move the game board business-wise.
Yeah.
And I knew that, but to have that personality test that works for people who are really running big companies validate that I'm in the 99th percentile for intuition, now I really know what I know.
Yeah. Totally.
And it's so helpful, you know, like, don't do that, do this. But the business part, you know, like Jamie had played in Austin with a 12-piece band or something.
Yeah, I grew into a big thing. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's cool. If you're in Austin, bring that on the road and let's see how it goes.
Best of luck.
It's so expensive. It's so expensive. I've had artists that are kind of household names at this point tell me they're not making any money. They got a bus. They got a band. They got a major label record deal. Their name's on the marquee. They're playing much bigger venues than me. And they're sinking because the business manager takes 5%. The booking agent takes 15%. The manager takes 10%. Do that math. That's 30% off the top of gross. And the net and the gross in this business are so wildly different. You can add $1 million and bring home 100,000. Flights.
I live that math.
Cars, hotel rooms, food. I mean, it's expensive. You're constantly doling out money. You're eating on the road, 3 meals a day. It is expensive to be out there with people. And so one of the things that like Jamie spoke of when we got together is I told her, get a passport. We're going to Europe. Yeah. And you're going to be opening the shows. And we're not bringing a band. She's like, oh, no.
Not even one little person?
No.
One person is $100,000. Yeah, I lost my mind.
Yeah, no, and it undid her, but then she rebuilt it, mm-hmm. and she can really do that now.
Yeah,
you know, the goal is for her to have a band, but I think that ultimately, the business, the numbers, and the way to run it is something that I'm passionate about the artist making a living. That everybody around them is making a living, but they're not. It's crazy.
Now, I think we have a big misconception in our culture that artists are not workers. Like, we are cultural laborers, and we deserve to have a living wage just like anybody else. But there's a disconnect culturally these days.
Well, when people on your team, the most important ones are commissioning your gross,
yeah,
not your net, that just doesn't work.
It's just rigged.
It worked in the old days. Mm-hmm. These aren't the old days. And so there's a movement to restructure it. And like, I have someone who provides management services for me, and I pay her a monthly fee. So she's not commissioning. People who work on commission tend to make more than the artist themselves after the bills are paid, especially in the first, let's say, a decade or so of building a career. So, yeah, the model is kind of busted.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've answered our next question. We were going to ask about management. Moving on.
Jamie, Mary's helped you on the business side of things, like we've talked about, and you said previously one of my struggles is worthiness. So how has being more business-oriented changed your sense of worthiness?
Well, I mean, that's something I'm working on in my life, is standing up for myself, just saying no when my gut feels like I shouldn't say yes. I mean, that's something I'm in recovery for, that stuff too. I mean, for being right-sized, for not shrinking myself. And I mean, like I said, I get to live my life with, I think, one of the greatest songwriters of all time. So even though, you know, there's some stuff where I'm like, well, yeah, that has to come from internally, it's nice to have some external validation, you know, about my art when I feel like, am I crazy for doing this? Am I delusional? Is this only happening because, I don't know, for whatever reason, like she's my partner in every way. So it's hard to untangle. She's also really good at letting me know, like, from, I mean, we consider ourselves partners, but sometimes I see her as my boss, like in the musical, right? She's the boss of the band. Hot. It's her name on them. She's the boss, you know? And there are times when she turns on the tough love, like, okay, because I started when I was 10 years old, I was always the youngest person in the bar playing music when I maybe shouldn't have been, I don't know. I'm always the kid. And she's like, you're not the kid anymore. Like, you need to sit in that seat. You need to rise. You know, she tells me when, she knows when I'm ready to level up. And that has helped me to activate the worthiness in myself.
Wow. Okay, well, we have one more question, and then I'd like you all to be prepared to do a lightning round, sort of newlywed game vibe. My last question is about that no that you were talking about, Jamie. Both of you are very approachable, warm and friendly, but as you've mentioned, you also have to set boundaries with people kind of coming into your space. So how do you strike the balance between saying yes when it matters and protecting your own energy and saying no when it matters?
I have to have help. I have help in that. Just like I've got help mm-hmm. to stay sober, I have people that I call that advise me when I need it sometimes. But I think one of the benefits of reintegrating my life mm-hmm. in sobriety is that I'm in touch with my gut again, because when I was in active addiction, I was like spinning out all over the place. So now that I know most of the time when my gut says, this might look like a really good opportunity on paper, this might look like, you know, for X, Y, and Z, there are reasons you should say yes to this. When my gut gives me that tiny little tinge of, don't do it, the more that I listen to it, I realize something more appropriate for my mission statement always comes in. Oh. when I end up in pain is when I go, no, but it looks good on paper. So we're going to ignore the 11 plus years of recovery and all the work that we're doing in our lives to get in touch with that gut. I'm just going to say, I'm not going to listen to you. I always end up angry. Yeah. I always end up in pain. And I always end up doing something that's not aligned with my mission statement.
Such a good answer.
Yeah.
Thank you. I got one. All right.
She said it.
Yeah. You said it all.
Lizzie, can you explain the rules for the lightning round?
Don't think too much. Answer as quickly as possible, straight from the gut. Okay, so we're going to do like a newlywed game style game called Which One, in which we're going to say, for example, which one looks better in pink? And then we'll kind of, you'll both quickly answer.
Well,
is it me or is it Jamie?
We'll do the countdown, three, two, one. The answers are Jamie, Mary, both of us, none of us.
Got it?
And you're not allowed to check with each other. You just have to say on three.
Okay.
We're going to be very strict about that. Okay.
I'll go first. Which one is doing the dishes?
Mary. Mary.
No countdown needed. I love that. Okay. Which one is driving? Three, two, one.
Jamie.
Great.
Which one waters the plants?
Three, two, one.
Mary. No plants.
Oh. That's right. We had one plant that died.
Thank you for your honesty in that. Which one plans the party? Three, two, one.
Mary.
Love it.
I want you to do this one.
Okay. Which one befriends babies? Three, two, one.
Both of
Jamie
us.
Jamie and Mary.
Aw, that's sweet.
Which one is petting every dog?
Three, two, one.
Jamie.
Okay, and final question. Which one can always be trusted to keep a secret? Three, two, one.
Jamie.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So fun.
Mary Gaucher, Jamie Harris, you have been such great guests. Thank you everyone for coming.
Thank you so much.
That was amazing. Oh my, great question. Wow.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Our music composed by Dietrich Strauss. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can find us on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can go to our website, BasicFolk.com, or you can listen wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this episode, we suggest sharing it with a friend. Like maybe that friend that you know that has been crushing on this very talented, kind of famous musician or athlete for many years, but they're like, I don't know. I don't know if I should make the move because maybe Jamie Harris and Mary Gaucher's story will be an inspiration to them and they will enjoy. Okay. I hope you are wonderful and thank you for listening all the way to the end. We'll see you next time. Bye.